Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. The Catholic Church is standing by the way it's handled allegations of sex abuse of children in its ranks, despite the Prime Minister's loss of faith in its approach and the announcement that a Royal Commission will be held. The inquiry will cover the treatment of children in all institutions, not just the Catholic Church. Julia Gillard says there's been a systemic failure to respond to the issue, and she's indicated recent revelations about priests being sheltered by the Church clinched her decision. The Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne and President of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference, Dennis Hart, has welcomed the scrutiny, but at the same time defended the integrity of the Church's procedures. Archbishop Hart is speaking here to reporter Lexi Metherill.
I would certainly believe that our procedures that we use since 1996 to address matters of abuse should be subject to appropriate scrutiny, and that scrutiny has my full support. And we will cooperate fully with the Royal Commission.
What do you think the effects of this Royal Commission will be on the Catholic Church in Australia?
I believe it will be a moment when all these matters can be faced. It will certainly help to clear the air, and for that reason I welcome it, because I think the community needs to know that these matters are being addressed skillfully and clearly and with determination. And I am determined to cooperate with that.
Then do you concede that the community's response to the Church's response to these matters has been one of scepticism?
Certainly, I'm only speaking with regard to Melbourne. We have, Cardinal Pell, before I was appointed, instituted what we call the Melbourne response, and he instituted an independent commissioner, an eminent lawyer, who is not interfered with or restricted in any way by the Church. I believe he has done an absolutely marvellous job to face this awful evil. I don't think it can be said with truth that simply because the Church has appointed him, that he is acting in any way other than with the greatest integrity. I don't know who he's seeing. I only know when he makes a recommendation, and in every case, I have accepted his recommendations.
So do you think that this Royal Commission could be a step towards rebuilding the public's confidence and faith in the Catholic Church in Australia?
I believe that the Catholic Church, the Catholic people, have great faith in the Church, great love of their priests, and great love of the overwhelming majority of priests who have been faithful. We do need this activity at this stage, this inquiry at this stage, to make quite sure that the right thing is being done to clear out for once and for all any doubt about the Church. And as I go round from parish to parish, I sense that there is a great love of the Church, a great love of priests, but a terrible scandal at the few who have offended so terribly.
The Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, Dennis Hart, speaking to Lexi Metherill. The victims of clergy abuse and their supporters say they're overjoyed that a national royal commission is to be held. They're optimistic that this most powerful type of inquiry will ensure their stories are heard and that cover-ups are exposed. Samantha Donovan reports.
As a schoolboy in the Victorian town of Ballarat in the 1970s, Stephen Woods was repeatedly sexually abused by three Catholic clergy. He says he's ecstatic that a royal commission has been announced.
I've been calling for a royal commission for over 15 years, and finally people have started to see the reality of what I have known, that clergy, in particular the Catholic Church, have just left a litany of tragic families of abuse. And so finally now, hopefully, everyone will have their say.
Stephen Woods believes a national royal commission can achieve more than smaller state-based inquiries.
The priest who raped me when I was 14, he was moved from parish to parish to parish to parish. He was moved into state, and he was moved overseas, and he came back, and every single place where he was, he molested and raped. Those are the types of career criminal paedophiles that will be and should be exposed in a national inquiry.
Anthony Foster is another long-time campaigner for a royal commission into the handling of child abuse. Two of his daughters were raped by their parish priest when they were in primary school. Emma Foster later committed suicide. Katie Foster took to drinking heavily and was hit by a car. She's now physically and mentally disabled and requires 24-hour care.
The National Royal Commission will provide the opportunity to victims in all states to achieve justice, to be able to tell their stories. And of course, it's just so much better than a parliamentary inquiry in Victoria. This Royal Commission will have the ability to ensure that all the documents that are required are actually gained and that the full knowledge of what's happened will be exposed.
It's not clear if New South Wales will go ahead with its inquiry into the police handling of clergy abuse claims in the Hunter Valley now that a wide-ranging national royal commission is to get underway. In a brief statement, New South Wales Premier Barry O'Farrell welcomed the Prime Minister's announcement. In Victoria, many abuse victims and their supporters were critical of the state government's decision to set up a parliamentary inquiry into the handling of child abuse rather than a royal commission. The Victorian inquiry is underway and due to report next year. The Victorian Premier, Ted Baillieu, says his government will work with the Parliamentary Committee and the Commonwealth to bring together the work of the two inquiries. Victim's father, Anthony Foster, thinks the Victorian inquiry should now be abandoned.
I see absolutely no point in continuing the current Victorian inquiry. All evidence and all information that's been presented to the Victorian inquiry should now be presented to the Federal Royal Commission, and there should be an undertaking from Premier Baillieu that he will implement every recommendation of the Federal inquiry.
Anthony Foster ending Samantha Donovan's report. Immigration authorities have serious concerns about the health of a man being held on Nauru who's on a hunger strike. The Iranian asylum seeker, known as Omid, hasn't eaten for 33 days. Another asylum seeker on Nauru has told AM hundreds of other protesting detainees haven't eaten this month, and 24 men transferred to detention on Nauru yesterday have joined the hunger strike. Will Ockenden reports.
There are currently 386 detainees in the Nauru Immigration Detention Facility, and asylum seekers say 305 of them are on a hunger strike. Syed Mohammed from Pakistan is one of them and says he's refusing food as a protest.
The guys are feeling very weak. More than 80 guys collapsed because of the hunger strike.
The Department of Immigration disputes the hunger strike's scale. A spokesman says the majority of detainees are eating and drinking regularly. Numbers of asylum seekers on Nauru are growing. 24 detainees, mostly Afghans but also Iranians, Iraqis and Sri Lankans, were transferred from Australia to Nauru yesterday. Syed Mohammed says they've already joined the hunger strike.
When they saw the condition here, they also just joined the hunger strike.
Most of the hunger strikers stopped eating on the 1st of November. But one man, an Iranian known as Omid, has gone 33 days without food.
You will just find him having a skeleton. The doctor told him that very soon your brain and your heart will stop working. He is just laying on a bed all day and night. He is even not able to walk properly.
A spokesman for the Immigration Department says the Iranian man is currently in a stable condition. He says the man is being closely monitored by doctors at the detention centre, but authorities are concerned. Medical experts say it's now a life-threatening situation. Louise Newman is a professor of psychology at Monash University.
Hunger striking, obviously, dehydration, but then we'll start to see suicidal thoughts and suicidal behaviours.
Amnesty International is also highly concerned about the ongoing hunger strike. It's planning to visit the detention centre later in the month. Dr. Graham Tom is the organisation's refugee spokesman.
We are hoping that the access we receive on Nauru will mirror the access that we get when we visit centres on the mainland. Obviously, Nauru is a sovereign country, so we're not necessarily guaranteed that, but we're going there under the assumption that we will be able to have full access.
An Immigration Department spokesman wasn't available for a recorded interview, but says the detention centre is slowly returning to normal, as 80% of the detainees are now taking part in daily activities. He says for Saturday and Sunday a fortnight ago, about 24 people were treated for dehydration, compared to only one person last weekend.
Will Ockenden reporting. And you're listening to AM around Australia, where it's 19 and a half minutes past seven. In what's seen as a worrying escalation, Israeli troops have fired tank shells into Syria, confirming direct hits on the source of a mortar round that earlier struck the Golan Heights. It was the second straight day that Israeli troops have been drawn into the Syrian conflict. Matt Brown, our Middle East correspondent, is in the Golan Heights. Matt Brown, good morning. What differentiates this exchange is that they were not warning shots, but the real deal, apparently.
That's right, Tony. The incident on the weekend was when a Syrian shell actually hit an Israeli military outpost on the Golan Heights, and that was met by return fire, a very accurate rocket, but a warning shot deliberately aimed not to hit Syrian forces. This time, the Israeli tanks have taken aim and fired on this Syrian artillery unit, and they've described it as a direct hit. And there are unconfirmed reports of at least two casualties.
So just why did Israel retaliate the way it did? After all, it was probably a stray mortar round from Syria, wasn't it?
Probably it was. I guess that Israel needed to send a message, a very clear one, obviously, that it doesn't want any further stray fire. After all, there was a shell that landed a kilometre or so from where I'm standing now in an Israeli community on the Golan Heights last Thursday. That could easily have caused civilian casualties. And the expectation in Israel of the kind of response that the Israeli government probably doesn't want to mount right now.
Matt, is there a chance this will escalate?
There is. There shouldn't be, in a sense that this has been really the most quiet area of all of Israel's borders for nearly 40 years. But look at what's happened in the last couple of days. So all bets and all usual calculations are off. From Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president's point of view, he can't afford to take on the Israeli military. From Israel's point of view, it doesn't want to get dragged into the Syrian civil war. It doesn't want this to be seen as a battle against the Zionist enemy. It would prefer to stay well out of it. But I think there is far too much now that is uncertain. And so what we've seen over the last few days is just this extraordinary level of uncertainty where Syrian military units are doing things which just wouldn't have been dreamed of in the not too recent past.
This area, Matt, is a very contentious border area between Syria and Israel, as you mentioned. Is anyone trying to hose down the conflict?
Yes, the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, has spoken of his very deep concern about what's happening here and urged all sides to show the utmost restraint and to respect the agreements that were signed in 1974 after the Yom Kippur War, which have kept this area relatively cool compared to the rest of the region. So a great deal of international concern.
Correspondent Matt Brown in the Golan Heights. The acting head of the beleaguered BBC has vowed to get a grip on who's actually in charge of the corporation's news operation. Tim Davey was speaking as two more senior executives stood aside in the wake of the broadcaster's bungled handling of two reports on sex abuse allegations. The BBC is now also under fire for agreeing to a payout of $685,000 for Mr. Davey's predecessor, George Entwistle, who was in the job for just 54 days. Europe correspondent Rachel Brown reports.
The BBC's evening current affairs programme Newsnight has become the story.
We start tonight with a statement issued in the last hour.
Overnight, the BBC's Director of News and her deputy agreed to step aside pending the outcome of an independent review. The Pollard Review is looking into why Newsnight shelved a report on sex abuse allegations against the late TV presenter Jimmy Savile. The BBC's Director General George Entwistle resigned over a separate Newsnight report which mistakenly implicated an ex-Tory figure in a Wales child sex abuse scandal in the 1980s. If Mr. Entwistle had hoped his resignation would help save face, he was wrong.
As George Entwistle has been given a huge payoff to go quietly, is my right honourable friend at all concerned that the BBC will try to use payoffs to ensure the silence of those implicated in the Savile and Newsnight scandals?
Yeah.
The man whose job it is to sort out the mess is the BBC's acting director general, Tim Davey.
If the public are going to get journalism they trust from the BBC, I have to be, as director general, very clear on who's running the news operation and ensuring that journalism that we put out passes muster. The first decision I've made is to get a grip of that, take action and build trust by putting a clear line of command in.
The chairman of the BBC Trust, Lord Paton, agrees the national broadcaster needs a shake-up, but many think it needs a radical break-up. Media analyst David Elstein is the former chief executive of Channel 5.
It's too hierarchical and too monolithic. I would much rather see news and current affairs separated. I would much rather see radio and television separated. I'd much rather see the news channel standing alone. I'd much rather see much shorter lines of authority, 2, 3, 4 people at most to the top in each of these areas.
As the BBC crisis continues, the Culture Secretary Maria Miller hopes it doesn't overshadow bigger issues.
We should not at all, at any point, forget the reason why these issues are under review right now. It is the sexual abuse of some of the most vulnerable people in society.
Police investigating Jimmy Savile and others have recorded 114 reports of alleged sexual assault. This is Rachel Brown in London reporting for AM.
This week's gathering of China's all-powerful Communist Party presents an opportunity for high-level cadres to examine their performances. The Chinese government may have been criticised recently for many things: human rights abuses, internet censorship, and an unfair legal system. Even its strongest suit, the economy, was looking a little shaky during the first half of the year. But the economic outlook is looking brighter for Australia's major trading partner. China correspondent Stephen McDonald reports from Beijing.
For most of this year, China's economy has been slowing down, and less steel production has meant less demand for Australian iron ore. The country's largest trading partner is Europe, so naturally the crisis there hit Chinese exports pretty hard. On top of that, the Chinese government put major restrictions on buying property in big cities to try and rein in prices. Yet now it all seems to be turning around, just in time for the new leadership to take control. Inflation has hit an almost 3-year low. Exports are up, manufacturing sentiment is up, and despite the restrictions, real estate investment is also on the rise. Many analysts think that China has bottomed out and that growth is picking up again. Zhang Ping is chairman of China's Economic Policy Department, the National Development and Reform Commission. He spoke to reporters at the Communist Party Congress. When we analysed the economic situation for the first half of the year, he said, we used the words slow but steady. But when we released the economic data for September, the comrades from the Statistics Bureau used a different word, rebound. The Communist Party has an unspoken pact with the people of China, that it deserves to hang on to power as long as everyone's lives keep improving in a material sense. And the delegates to this week's Congress know that they may be criticised for a lot of things, but on the economy, many believe they're doing a pretty good job. When demand from Europe and the United States collapsed, policymakers tried to boost domestic demand by encouraging local consumption. And if the figures released over recent days are any indication, it seems to be working. Jing Ulrich is Managing Director and Chairman of Global Markets China for JP Morgan.
China can no longer count on external exports to drive economic growth. All the growth we're seeing today, 7% plus, is coming from internal sources.
Jing Ulrich also says that as the Chinese economy expands, a 7% GDP growth is worth much more than it used to be.
Even though growth rate has come down from about 10% to 7.5%, we have to remember the size of the GDP is so huge now. This year, China's $8.5 trillion. The U.S. economy is $14 trillion. For such a large economy to grow at 10% into perpetuity is not possible. So even though growth rates are around 7 or 7.5%, we think those growth rates are still very robust by any measure.
In the coming days, economist Li Keqiang will be installed as number two leader. Wang Qishan, who's been China's negotiator with the United States on economic matters, could come in at number three. This means economic specialists will hold senior positions in the new Politburo Standing Committee, a body once dominated by engineers. They know they're inheriting problems with inefficiency, corruption, and overproduction in certain industries. The country they're taking over is without the pressure of mass unemployment and recession that are seen elsewhere. They'd have to be cautiously optimistic. This is Stephen McDonald in Beijing for AM.
to finance. I'm not sure whether they heard the music there, but Wall Street traded slightly higher as it recovers from the worst fall since June. Earlier, markets in Europe ended weaker because of uncertainty about Greece and whether EU finance ministers will sign off on additional financial aid. The dollar is buying 104.3 US cents. That's largely steady. It's buying 82.9 Japanese yen, just on 82 euro cents. Tapas crude in Singapore up by $5 a barrel. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for today.